It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. People are sharing a lot on social media, from vacation photos to music and book choices. This oversharing of information is extending to the bold and casual admittance of criminal activity. Here to look at the role social media is playing in the committing, investigation, and prosecution of crimes is David Harris, distinguished faculty scholar and professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. David, welcome back. How are you?
Very well, Paul. Good to be with you again.
And this certainly dovetails nicely with what we were just talking about. And if you would like to join the conversation, have a question or comment for our guest, David Harris, 412-246-2002, the number to call, 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. David, what would make somebody want to brazenly share some sort of information on a Facebook page or on some sort of social media that anybody could have access to and ultimately use against them? What's going on? Is there like a false sense of security there?
I suppose you could say that, Paul. You know, I have younger kids. My kids are 20 and 23. They've grown up with Facebook and with things like that. And, of course, my students are all in their 20s, just about all of them. And what I notice is that people in those age ranges pretty much live their lives online. I mean, they have friends, of course, that are, you know, and then they see them physically, but their entire existence is sort of mapped out online. If you don't post about it, if you don't have a photo about it that you put up on Facebook or something like that, well, it's like it didn't happen. And so there's no reason, I guess, that this wouldn't carry over into groups of people who are engaged in conduct that is criminal. I mean, we've all heard the stories of a kid, a very good kid, let's say, and graduates from college but can't get a job and discovers that the employers are finding his Facebook photos of him smoking dope or drinking excessively or something like that. People don't realize that the things they are sharing are not just shared with their friends. They are out there. Everybody can see them. Privacy settings help, but if you don't pay attention to them, they don't help at all. So we're at a point where social media is such a pervasive force in the life of people, especially young people, that lots of their conduct in the physical world ends up on social media. And so police, looking at this, if they're smart, they will use social media as a source of clues.
And we hear about computers, laptops being confiscated. You know, somebody's hard drive is taken and it's used for evidence. Why isn't some of this information protected under privacy laws? And if someone wants access to it, do they need the same kind of warrant they would need if they search your house?
Not that same kind that they would need if they search your house, because it's a possession. Now, Fourth Amendment covers persons, houses, papers, and effects. And certainly your computer drive and things like that, those are effects and the same as papers as far as I'm concerned.
Sure. Even though our founding fathers would not have envisioned that, that really is a logical extension of what they had in mind.
Absolutely it is. But the thing is, when people put their information on social media, it's out there. It's not just in their computer. It's on a network somewhere. There is a well-established doctrine in the Fourth Amendment called the third-party doctrine. If you transmit information to a third party for any purpose, it is considered no longer private. So
that's the line that you cross?
That's the line that you cross. So if I transmit information to my bank when I cash a check, if I transmit information to the phone company when I dial a phone number, the Supreme Court has ruled that that is no longer private because a third party has it. Now, I have real problems with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, that doesn't make – if something is a transaction, presumably that's protected. That is considered a personal business dealing that
– Well, it's protected as far as laws and statutes. We may have banking privacy laws, but the Constitution does not protect it as private – either as a possession or as speech.
And so if I take it to the bank and physically hand the payment to somebody, that's or the deposit or whatever, that's different than if I do it online?
No, it isn't. The information that ends up in the bank's records comes from the physical piece of paper just like it would from a data transmission. The point here is that when somebody uses Facebook or when somebody uses any kind of social media, it is going to a third party, that information, and therefore you can't expect privacy in it. And I think people just don't realize that, number one. Number two, there is this culture now of, as you said in your introduction, oversharing. If it doesn't happen, if it's not online and if there's not a picture, it's like it didn't happen. So, for instance, one of the cases in which social media played the most important role is the Steubenville, Ohio rape case. And if you were listening to the news at the top of the hour, there were some indictments in that case today. That case would not have come to anyone's notice but for the fact that people at those parties were posting about them, that there was a video out there. All of this stuff was out there. Without that, there would have been no evidence at all and no case.
So what is the common mistake that people make in terms of assuming that something is going to be private that isn't? And why don't they know better?
Well, I think people know better if they think about it. But I think it really does go back to the fact that folks, especially in the younger age groups, have just lived with social media for their entire conscious lives. It's the way that they are in touch with each other and with the world. And they think of it like you and I having a conversation out in the lobby. And it's all accepted that way. That's the way people have done it. And there's a great temptation to simply go ahead and have it out there, and their friends can see it, but they don't realize that it's out there for everybody to see. I think a good rule would be, if you wouldn't want something seen on the front page of the newspaper, don't email about it and don't post about it. Now, of course, a lot of these folks have never read newspapers, so maybe they don't get that either. But on the other hand, if you put it out there, it can be gotten. If you delete it, it can be gotten. Just don't. And a lot of people simply don't think before they do this. Social media is great. I'm not telling anybody not to do it. I use it. I blog. I use Facebook. I post in a lot of different formats. But you got to put things out there you want other people to see. Because if you put things on there that are just for a few folks, it doesn't work like that.
We're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about the increased sharing that goes on social media and how this oversharing can lead to the casual admittance of criminal activity that can or will be used against you in a court of law. Explain how the courts view this information. Is there a distinction that can be made between some things on social media being acceptable and others not, or is it all fair game?
It's pretty much all fair game if you put it out there. There are laws and rules about your electronic communications, like email, for instance, about when the government can open them, about whether the police would need a subpoena or a search warrant or some other kind of thing. What people need to know in general is that there's a lot less protection than they imagine. But what we're talking about here is people who either use the social media to commit crime or who brag about it as if they're sitting on a bar stool on Facebook to their friends. So in the category of committing crime, you get people who try to commit fraud or something via social media or via basic things like email. You know, those emails you get where they say, send us your bank account, blah, blah, blah. Or a phishing, P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G, a phishing email that purports to look like it's from your bank, and you need to check in and do this link, that sort of thing. Those are frauds. The other type is where people are simply communicating to each other the fact that they are engaged in criminal activity. One good example that I did read about was where witnesses had their people who were going to testify in court had their names and pictures posted on Facebook pages to show that they were snitches. This was a way of intimidating them. And this, to me, this is a direct subversion of the justice system. Now, if word went around a neighborhood that somebody was going to testify against a criminal or against a gangster, that would be one thing. But putting it up on Facebook, that is as if it's on every telephone pole. There's some kind of little poster for 5,000 miles around, and it just doesn't go away. It's very, very dangerous. So all of these kinds of things, you can commit crimes through it, and you can effectively just post information about crimes that have already happened. Then, of course, we have crimes like the use of social media by pedophiles to try to reel in victims and so forth.
Right, and that's a more overt use of technology, of social media to commit a crime.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's in its way, it's on the same scale as people committing financial frauds, but of course the harm is much more damaging to the victims. It is fair game for police then to use the same sort of medium to attempt to lure the predators in. Mm. I teach a case about that in my criminal law class. We have a police department officer who goes online and pretends to be a 13-year-old girl, gets some man talking to her, and the man moves in a sexual direction and so forth, and they eventually arrest him.
And years ago, some of our older listeners would remember AbScam.
Yes.
And there were some a few hitches in that, because there was some of the evidence that was used was videotaped, and there were FBI agents, federal authorities, who were luring officials into admitting that they were involved in these illegal activities involving,
yes,
the transfer of funds, bribery, that kind of thing. Is there a line that is drawn there between is it fair game to lure a predator out like that? I mean, I'm sure,
yes,
people who want these kinds of people to be caught would say yes. But are there certain ways that you can get tripped up doing that?
Absolutely. I know you're referring to the cases back several decades in which government officials were lured in by promises of money payments and things like that. And it was all videotaped. This was a sting operation some years ago, AbScam. The line that the government can go up to but not cross is called entrapment. A lot of people have probably heard of that. You can offer the potential criminal the opportunity to commit a crime, whether online or in a hotel room. Mm-hmm. The government can do that. It can even offer very enticing opportunities, things like what they did to Marion Barry years ago, who was the mayor of D.C., put him in a room with a crack pipe and a woman with a camera rolling that he doesn't know about. The only way that that's not allowed is if somehow the government pressures the target into doing something that he or she would not have done. So as long as the target has an inclination to go along with the temptation that's sort of put out there as bait, the government can go pretty far. So entrapment law is not as much protection as people tend to think when they first hear about it. As far as cases online, it works exactly the same way. The case I was talking about a minute ago, the police go out there, they pretend to be young kids or girls or boys or whatever it is. That sort of thing is allowed.
We're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris. If you have a comment or question, would like to join the conversation, 412-246-2002, the number to call. You may want to know what the line is, where it's drawn, and how you may end up crossing it, even inadvertently, on social media. David clearly has some very important advice for those who are interested in seeking it, and so you can get that right here. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. When the police confiscate somebody's information on Facebook, how do they do that? Do they simply go online like we would and just access somebody's Facebook page, and then whatever they find then becomes evidence?
Well, they could start that way. They could go online and see whatever is public. But if they know the person's identity, my understanding is that they would then go to the internet service provider, Facebook or Google or whoever, with a subpoena. And they would subpoena records from the ISP for all of the documentation, the communications, and so forth, be it email or Facebook postings or whatever. Now, a subpoena is easier to get than a search warrant. You're not required to go to a judge and prove that you have probable cause. A subpoena is almost there for the taking from a prosecutor's office. You've got to swear out some things, and that's it. And so it's a much easier process. What is happening now, and the next cases to come up to the courts, will be cases in which police confiscate people's cell phones when they get arrested. This is what's coming. And we all know about smartphones. We got Facebook on our phones. We got Twitter on our phones. And what police departments are wanting to do increasingly is to take that confiscated phone and go through it. And the courts are going to be asked whether going through somebody's phone should require a warrant. In my opinion, it should.
Right.
But courts have ruled in both directions, and I see that as headed for the Supreme Court sometime in the next 2 years.
Really?
Yes.
And it's amazing that it hasn't been for as long as cell phones have been around, and now with the ability to go on the internet and with those devices, you would have thought this would have been decided already. But as you say, it's not yet. Dana in Bellevue is on the line with a question. Dana, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. I'm glad you took my call.
You bet. I want
to know how we can protect ourselves from, just as you're saying, with pictures taken with cell phones. If I don't want my picture spread out there and posted on Facebook, how can I control that from somebody else taking my picture and their decision to post?
Hmm. I would tell you first, Dana, I'm no expert at how Facebook works or any of that. I use it as much as I'm capable of, which, as my kids would tell you, is not really a lot. But I will tell you this. If you don't want your picture taken and posted, the best thing to do is when you're at that family gathering, when you're out with your friends, you tell them, I don't mind you having a picture, but I do not want my face posted. This is something one of my brothers does all the time, to the great consternation of some of my sisters-in-law and cousins and so forth. But he just doesn't want it. He doesn't want his face out there. And it really is on us, first and foremost, to make sure it doesn't happen.
Let's take a quick call. We're just about out of time. But Charles from Westmoreland County, you're in Just Under the Wire. Go ahead with your comment or question for David Harris.
Just a quick clarification. You mentioned that there's no expectation of privacy for a third party. But what about the one party to a second party? That's all. Thank you.
Okay, good question.
To a second party, your communications are usually going to be protected as long as it is private. Essentially a phone call or a letter or things like that. But when you submit something to a third party, like a bank, for processing, it has surprisingly little protection. And so you end up, if you want to avoid those, you ended up living in the cash economy, no phone service, no banks and things like that. And it's a very difficult life to have in today's world.
Thank you for that question, Charles. And I guess my last question would be in 10 seconds or so. What did you think of the news today that in New York City they're going to have mounted police officers on top of horses looking down at people using their devices in their cars to see if they're texting while driving?
As long as it's in plain view, they're allowed to do that. And plain view, I suppose, could be from the top of a horse.
David Harris, Pitt Law Professor, as always, thank you for being with us.
All right. Very good to be with you, Paul.
And thanks for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening.